just insisted on stopping. Everybody's a real lonesome. Well, the next two or three days, I loaded on about 1,000 pounds of moose. More than I should, of course, with that 25 miles of new trail. But I started back, intending to stop with this fellow when I got there. Well, I just about killed myself and my dogs, too. It was cold. It was, I imagine, 30 below. And we just all worked our cussed heads off of getting to that cabin. And when I first come in sight of it, there was something that looked kind of odd to me. I couldn't tell what it was, but it was odd. As I got close, the darn thing looked like an eagle. It went out to that freshwater stream and dipped water and just threw it all over that cabin and then it froze. Well, I thought, gee, that's funny. That ain't no way to do. But anyhow, I went up and stopped my dogs and knocked at the door. And no answer, and I could see smoke coming out. And surely he was in, but I just opened the door and walked in. And there he was, laying on his bunk, on his back. And he had an old magazine, and he would just thumb that magazine like crazy, 8-10 leaves at a time, just fast as he'd thumb them. Then he'd raise that up close to his face and look at it. Then he'd take it down and he'd thumb it again. And boy, he was just thumbing that magazine through and through and through and through, and he just kept doing that. I talked to him, and he never answered me, never looked at him, paid no attention to me whatsoever. Well, I knew there was so many people going crazy those days that I knew he'd lost his mind. Poor devil. And, well, as we went over, I noticed that he didn't have any gun. And then again, since I saw he's crazy, I commenced looking for a gun. None in sight. And, gee, I thought it was kind of funny, a man out there like that and didn't have a gun. So many did. But occasionally you find them didn't, so I didn't think anything of it. Well, I went ahead and got my supper and asked him to come and have some with him, but he just thumbed his magazine. That's all there went to it. Never even paid no attention whatsoever. Well, I fed my dogs and spread out in my sleeping bag and crawled into it. Well, when I did that, he blew the light out at the head of the bed. He had a candle at the head of his bed and one at the foot of his bed. 2 candles burning all the time. Well, he blew out the one at the head of his bed. He reached down beside of his bunk and he pulled out a brand new 30-30 rifle and he shot the light out at the lower end. Well, you don't have to hit a light like that if you shoot within 4 inches of it, you know, you put it out. But anyhow, I didn't wait to think, or you just don't think when you do things like that. I just rolled. That is all there was to it. And when I stopped, I was right at the door going outside. And I listened. I could hear him putting my rifle back. And I knew I couldn't lay there asleep all night, or wake all night. It just couldn't be done. I knew I was too tired, too all in. I knew I'd fall asleep. So I got a wondering what the devil I was going to do. Well, I laid there and just dying for sleep, and, but I was resting some, and was scared still. And finally I heard him breathing hard. I knew he was asleep. I thought, well, I got one chance. So I sneaked out of my sleeping bag and crawled over his bunk, and sure enough, just as I reached down beside of the bunk, I felt the rifle. I pulled it out just as easy, no noise, no nothing, just slipped that rifle out so easy it surprised me. And I crawled back over to my bunk and my sleeping bag and I put it under me. And I crawled in and I went to sleep. I couldn't do anything else. Well, it was daylight next morning when I woke up. He was laying with his back to me and his face to the wall. Well, I got up, I spoke to him, not a word. He never let on. I knew he wasn't asleep, but he was pretending he was. Well, I went ahead and got my breakfast. Got things all fixed up, his dishes washed, everything, some kindling whittled, everything nice and clean. And went and rolled up my bed. And I rolled his rifle up in it, and I put it on my sled. I hooked up my dogs. I had him tied to a tree close by. I went back in to see if he's all right and spoke to him again. No answer. He's still laying face to the wall. Out with that rifle on my sled. Well, when I got to town, I told the marshal. He went out and got me. Got him. But they told me after that he never spoke a word to anybody from that till they got him to Morningside in Oregon. Well, I think beyond a doubt that was the toughest winter I ever see in the North. when I come out, that sudden change. And I come out over the trail not long after that, and there were 7 people froze to death. One had froze to death in the stage of going over. A father had froze to death, and son froze to death. There was one man walked 75 miles on feet, just frozen solid. When he got into Fairbanks, they had to take them both off, just below the knee. Man had a lot of crust to do that, I'm telling you. But you know, about this time, there was, here's what I learned, I wasn't a cook. About this time, they was putting a second line from Valdez to Fairbanks. A friend of mine come to me, and I was out of a job, broke, of course. And he said, Slim, you want a job? I said, yeah. Well, he said, there's a cooking job out on the telegraph line. Well, I was a pretty fair cook and decided I'd take it. And they told me that the cook is quitting, and I didn't know who he was. So I started out. It was about 150 miles to where they were, and, well, he said, you get out there, they can't fire you, because he said, the pack train won't catch you. He said, they're going to be out of grub, I'm afraid, but he said, do the best you can. So I went out, and sure enough, the cook was a very good friend of mine. They called him Beaver Dam Bob, and he was an excellent cook. He was noted for being such a good cook. So I said to him, what's the matter, Bob? You're quitting. Well, he said, there's no grub. He said, there's just nothing to cook. And he said, the man that cooks here this summer, he said, he's going to get himself an awful name. He said, he's never going to be able to get another job. And, well, I said, I don't care whether I get another job or not, and I'll tell you what I'll do. And I said, you want to go on to the outfit? He said, yeah, I'd like to go on. But he said, I won't cook. I said, all right, now, Bob, I'll cook. I'll be the cook and take all the blame. And the cook was getting a dollar more than the flunky was. So I said, we'll split the dollar, and you can help me with the cooking, I'll help you with the flunkying, and I said, we'll just have a good time this summer. Well, he was a swell guy. I liked him a lot. He was an Englishman. And you know, the only thing I didn't like about him, the ice was freezing out of the lake, and it'd be froze 10 or 15 feet from the shore. He'd go out in the morning when he first got up, and he'd dive into that water, swim out on the ice, and climb up on it, dive back, and swim back to shore. And he'd come in and tell me how good that made him feel, you know, for me to do it. Well, if I figured if that was all what it took to make a man feel good, I just wasn't going to feel good. That's all there was to it. But anyhow, we went on through the line. No grub ever got to us. That trail was so tough they couldn't make it. And so we just had to depend on what we could get from relief stations along, which wasn't much. It was pretty tough grub. But we went and done a lot of hunting, and we even killed about 50 of them little squirrels and made a pie out of them one day. We just done everything we could. We had lots of cornstarch, so we fed them lots of cornstarch pudding. We had lots of milk. But sometimes we'd be so cussed short of flour. We just short of everything all winter. And we did live tough. Well, anyhow, we was out of clothes, too. One fella got a piece of canvas and made him a pair of overalls. Boy, if he wasn't a comical-looking thing in them overalls. It was just made like 2 sacks. Anyhow, we got the line finished and started back to Valdez. Well, it's getting late, and by the time we got into Valdez, why, we was just the raggedest bunch that had ever hit it. And there was a little fellow by the name of McCarty. He had a bad foot, born that way, I guess, but he was an awful nice little fellow, and he strung our wire for us. He had a horse. He'd hooked that horse on the end of a wire, wire on a spool, of course, and he'd get straddled a horse, and away he'd go across that country where it wasn't possible to take a horse. Of course, they'd take it by hand. But anyhow, he was about the first one into town on his little horse, and I went to my cabin and kind of got cleaned up and decided I'd go downtown. I walked into a saloon, and here was little McCarty just hanging on to the bar. He had to hang on because he couldn't stand up if he'd let go. He looked at me, and for a while, he said, well, come on, Slim, just come and have a drink. Well, I was very poor-hand at drinking, but you got to treat a drunk man right, and a drunk man always tells the truth, too. And so I went to have a drink with him, and he kind of looked up at me, kind of stupid, and he says, Slim, he says, I like you. He says, the fact is, all the boys like you. He says, if they had known that it'd kill you. Because can't cook. Near this. I'm so mixed up on dates you can't remember. But I'm a partner set on our sleds and watched Halley's Comet. Now, we can find out when that went through there. But that was quite a sight. Watching that thing skid across the sky, beautiful sight, and will lift the country up quite a bit. We ought to be able to find out if we want to use it where that was. Well, early in the spring of 10, no, 11, I was up at Seward, and I got to talking to the young Indian fella there, and he got to tell me about the Valley of 10,000 Smokes. Well, he told us later he'd never seen it, but he said, my papa seen it. There was Wendigo there, and none of them went, but he'd like to see it, and he kind of thought it'd be nice if we'd go see it. So we did. We got on the old Dora and went over, and didn't take much outfit. But we went to see the Valley of 10,000 Smokes. Well, that's just as good a name of it as I can think about. It was a honey. It was about 5 or 6 miles long, and I'd say about a mile wide in a crater. And it was just marvelous vegetation, and they're beautiful things. And water just as cold as ice, and water just, you could boil coffee on it. It's just hot as a 45 is all the way to it. And, well, sir, I liked that, and I just decided that I'd go back and get some grub and some outfit and go in there and build a cabin and trap during the winter of 11 and 12. Well, when I got back to Seward, well, there's a letter there from a partner, and he'd got a lay on some ground that we'd been trying to get a lay on. It was good ground, but short of water. If it was a good summer and warm and lots of snow in the winter, why, you could make some good money there, and we knew it. But, of course, if it was dry, why, we'd just be out of luck. That's all it would took. So I just decided I'd leave the Valley of 10,000 Smokes go for a few years and go back. So I went back and went in with Hazlitt that I was telling you about, that his boy died on the trip, and spent the summer. Well, we didn't do bad, done pretty good, and long middle of the summer, we begin to hear blasting down below. It sounded, we wondered, was it on the road commission, just where was it, that blasting going on, you know, and finally, one morning, we got up, and our picks and shovels all looked like copper. Well, about that time, somebody come in and told us that Katamai had blowed up. Well, now, at that time, we was about 500 miles from Katamai. But, nevertheless, the ashes come in. If I'd have been on top of that, I'd have been a pretty mess today, I'm telling you. But that was 12. Well, that winter, we went into the Wrangles again, built us another cabin, and trapped. Good country. Boy, it is nice trapping. And